From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. For the first couple hours tonight, emerging artist bumper music for you. And later on, will October 7th be the physical end of the world? Find out why one person thinks so. Here's what's happening. Families of those missing on Malaysia Airlines flight MH370 have rejected a report issued on the first anniversary now of the plane's disappearance. It's been a year already. The interim report gives no clues as to what happened to the plane. One relative described it as simply useless. It does reveal that an underwater locator beacon battery expired a year before the plane disappeared, but it's unclear whether this affected the search. The airliner, of course, was flying from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing when it vanished. Malaysia and Australia say they remain committed to finding the missing plane. 239 people aboard that plane when it went down. James Sanders, who's been with us since the beginning of this situation, and also the author of The Downing of TWA Flight 800, with us on this anniversary night. James, first and foremost, again, the battery beacon expired a year before the plane went down. This thing was just a comedy of mistakes.
Sadly. Right, and that's the certificate, you know, the certificate sign-off on it. So if it had gone down in that area, I think it's reasonable to assume that it would have operated for some period of time, but maybe not as long as they thought. But, you know, this report that they issued is quite revealing that it's, purpose was not to apportion, and I'm quoting here, to apportion blame or liability. Is that amazing or what?
Well,
nobody out there, there's no official organization out there with that purpose.
No, that's true. And as we've been talking over the year, Jim, I still think something is bizarre about this entire case. You know, your thoughts that it may have landed in Somalia and we may have blown it up because it was going to be a targeted terrorist vehicle, you know, it's just weird. This whole thing is weird.
Right. If as we believe it was a terrorist event, certainly it was obviously taken care of. Otherwise, and it was taken, it had to be taken care of in the way we're talking about. Otherwise, there would be evidence of it and things would have leaked out. But keep in mind that this is the backyard of the Mossad. So I suspect that they are the most professional organization in the world for these types of things, and not that they did it without our vital assistance, but for something to have been taken care of, apparently been taken care of in such a professional manner, I think you have to give them the nod.
All right, and of course, Tuesday night, Richard Belzer, one of our co-authors in the book, Someone is Hiding Something, will be our guest for a couple hours talking about this case, too. A record-breaking attempt to fly around the world in a solar-powered plane is set to get underway tomorrow. The aircraft, called the Solar Impulse 2, will take off from Abu Dhabi and head first to Oman and then on to India. Over the next 5 months, it will skip from continent to continent, crossing both the Pacific and Atlantic Oceans in the process. Listen to this incredible story. A baby girl has been found alive in a car more than 14 hours after the vehicle plunged into a river in Utah. The 18-month-old was discovered hanging upside down above the water in her car seat by a fisherman on Saturday afternoon. Little baby was rushed to the hospital in Salt Lake City. Her condition has been upgraded from critical to stable. Sadly, the toddler's 25-year-old mother was found dead in the driver's seat. Scotland Yard, they want every homeowner to consider putting cameras in their houses to trap burglars. The country's most senior police officer out there saying, got to do this. Police forces need more crime scene footage to match against their 12 million images of suspects and offenders. He called on families and businesses to install cameras at eye level to exploit advances in facial recognition technology. You know, in the past 8 months, ISIS has seated itself in some dozen countries now around the globe. Indicative of this was an announcement that the Nigerian terrorist group Boko Haram had pledged its allegiance to the caliph of the Muslims, the ISIS leader Baghdadi. Let's check in with Jerry Corsi, author, of course, and writes for WND.com. Is it getting bigger, or are the troops going to go mass and take care of ISIS, Jerry?
Well, I think ISIS is expanding its reach. I mean, ISIS is now known to be well established in Libya, and this Boko Haram announcement today, while it seems mostly to be cosmetics, you know, similar kinds of graphics produced in their videos, similar kinds of announcements together. Boko Haram is certainly pledging its loyalty to ISIS, and that expands the presence of ISIS into Nigeria, which is, of course, south of Libya and Egypt, and a very dangerous group, making ISIS now having a more continental reach into Africa.
You know, I was watching an old documentary about D-Day, you know, Normandy, 1944, how we hushed it up. We hit the beach. The Germans didn't expect it. And here we are announcing, hey, we're going to go into Mosul and Tikrit, and we're going to do this and that. What are we doing, Jerry? Why don't we keep our mouths shut and just do what we have to do?
Well, I think that's a good point. And the Pentagon has been criticized in the Obama administration for announcing that, for instance, by April, we're going to try an assault to take back Mosul. And yet the same point is, while the battle is going on for Tikrit, which is really the gateway to Mosul, the United States is not taking an active part in the bombing, which we've been doing against ISIS. Most of the battle in Tikrit is being taken by various Iraqi forces, but predominantly with the assistance of Iran and al-Quds, which is the Revolutionary Guard, with one of the Soleimani, who's one of the top generals in the Revolutionary Guard in Iran, pretty much leading the charge against Tikrit, with the United States sitting on the sidelines. So how are we going to get back involved in the attempt to take Mosul should this attempt to take Tikrit prove successful, and everyone seems to believe it will be successful? That's an open question. Again, George, we're announcing plans, the United States, of what we want to do in Iraq, like Mosul, but yet we're not following through with believable steps in Tikrit.
And Jerry, thank you for participating in our roundtable discussion on ISIS last week. I get lots of emails about your performance. Thank you so much.
Well, it was really an honor and a pleasure. I thought you did a great job, George. People don't realize how difficult it is for a moderator like yourself to make a program seem simple on such a complex subject. I thought you did a great job, and I was delighted to have a chance to participate.
Talk to you again. Jerry Corsi. A new study has found that for each hour a day that an adult spends sitting down during their lifetime, each hour a day, the likelihood of developing heart disease goes up by 14%. So get up and move around. Don't sit. A dog has been used to sniff out thyroid cancer in people who had not yet been diagnosed, according to researchers. Tests on 34 patients showed an 88% success rate in finding tumors. That is unbelievable. Have you ever had a tragedy, and have you been able to bounce back from it? Up next, Alan Lucas joins us through the flames on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. For the next couple hours, we are going to be talking about a miracle. And we're going to be talking about, of course, what happened after that situation. Alan Lucas is the founder, guiding teacher of the Community Meditation Center in the city of New York. He has taught a number of people musicals, operas, concerts for so many years. He's an author. He has taught in such places as Columbia University, the Albert Einstein College of Medicine. But this is going to be different for you. And here's Alan on the show. Alan, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Through the Flames, when I first started looking at the book, I thought, we're going to read a book here about something, about a disaster. It got more than that. It got very personal. It got to be what you went through that I don't think anybody would want to change places with, Alan.
No, I'm sure that's true, and it is also very true. What you said about the book being very personal, there was a serious accident. Some people have told me that I lived their worst nightmare by being in a plane crash. You know, I would just want to say in advance of this, because through this incident, I've learned a lot about the nature of trauma. So just to advise listeners that this is a pretty grim story. I try to keep it as truthful as possible. Mm-hmm. I don't think it needs embellishment, but it's still real. So just to remind people, I'm here and alive. I'm doing very well. But it goes back to Christmas Day of 2012. My wife and I were vacationing in Myanmar, or probably better known as Burma. Mm-hmm. And we were to take a short flight from Mandalay to Hihoe. These are just small towns. But the flight never arrived at its destination. It came down what was officially called pilot error, nowhere near the airport. We crashed into an abandoned rice field, we being a total of 71 people on the plane. On the way down, where we were not supposed to be, the wings of the plane sheared through heavy electrical cable, and they sparked, and the plane burst into flames. That was actually the biggest problem. The object was to get out of that plane because it was filling very quickly with a thick, black, dense smoke, which was the fuel burning. There was chaos in the plane. It was just a chaotic mess, and people rushing and pushing. I foolishly stood up and called out to everybody to just be calm and take it easy. We'll all get out. But of course, nobody was listening to that. They just wanted to get out. Yeah. My wife then turned to me and said, she's not going to make it. She's already choking on the fumes, and because we were pretty far back. We saw to our left that there was an exit, emergency exit door that had probably popped open in the crash. The problem is that it was engulfed in flames, and to get out that emergency door, we would have to jump through the flames. But we immediately agreed that that was it. That was our option, and we had to do it.
It was getting that bad in the plane.
You
would rather jump through flames than to get the smoke.
It was the only option at that point, yeah. So I gave her a big push, and out she went. We didn't know at that time that she had suffered 4 broken vertebrae and crushed discs, etc. But she went out, you know, just jumped out through the flames. My intention was to follow right after her, but as things happened, my left foot caught on something, and I couldn't see what it was because of the smoke. And there I was, stuck in the fire.
Trapped.
Literally in the fire.
Oh, burning, trapped, stuck in the plane.
Yeah, yeah.
My God.
The interesting thing is, and of course now I can sit back and say this was interesting, at the time, I assure you, I was beyond scared. It was terrifying, and I knew it. But at the same time, I was calm and fully present to the situation. I knew that I had to get my foot free somehow. So, you know, I've been asked many times, as you mentioned, I am a guiding teacher of a meditation center. How did meditation or contemplative practices play into this? I would think that the very fact that I was in a scary situation and yet calm at the same time probably is a factor of some 20 years of meditation practice. There then was a period right at that point when what psychotherapists sometimes refer to as the benevolent brain, meaning that I have a blank spot in my memory from that moment when I was stuck to the moment when I had then jumped out of the plane, I'd freed myself, and the next thing I know, I was on the ground, but clearly in shock and clearly in very bad shape. I got help getting pulled away from the plane. The medical care in Myanmar is pretty much non-existent. It would be safe to say if I were Burmese, I would be dead, as would be my wife. The doctor in Burma took a quick look at me and sort of nodded to my wife, no way, you know, this man can't survive. I had suffered burns over a third of my body, and they were deep. What today are called full thickness burns.
Yes.
Used to be called third degree burns. And then the same thing, we managed, or actually my wife managed, she's the hero of this story. got me out of Burma with some help from the American embassy, got me to Bangkok. Doctors there, same thing, can't, you know, you can't live through injuries like this. Then on to Singapore, where there is a very good burn unit, and met an incredible doctor. I mean, just skills beyond what one could imagine, and a true healer. He was the first person to say, no, you're not necessarily going to die. You may regain good function of your hands. After 7 days there, they medevaced me back home to New York City.
What a long flight that was for you.
30 hours. Yeah, 30 hours. Five stops. The red tape, the political maneuvering that my wife had to go through, not to mention providing an instantaneous $250,000 deposit to get me into Singapore General Hospital. It was really beyond what one would expect that a human being could do, but she did.
Let me ask you, it's not to pry into your personal finances, but where'd the $250,000 deposit come from? I mean, did the government come up with it, or did you have to?
No, well, you know, I don't know about when you travel, but I don't carry that kind of money with
no,
me.
No, not at all.
And on the other end of the world, she was dealing with time zones and trying to reach our broker, trying to reach credit cards. It was difficult to do, but she did maneuver it, and it was done.
Amazing. Now, what would have happened had she not been able to raise that kind of money?
You don't get admitted. It's not like here.
Okay, so you're gone.
You just don't get admitted, and that would have been the end for me. But we were, and that happened. You know, you referred to a miracle. We can go back in a minute and look at the various miraculous moments in this. But we'll just pick up and get me to New York on that medevac flight, where the initial doctors again said the same thing. These injuries are too severe. I don't think we can save him. At one point, when the doctor said to her, you know, there's no way this man can survive, she just said, no, you don't know this man. And later when I heard that, I thought to myself, what that was really about is he didn't know that woman. You know,
that's
no way
right.
She's going to let me
she's
die on her watch.
No. And were you aware of any of this at
no.
that time? You were out.
No.
You're out of it. Okay.
No. You know, I didn't know until almost 2 years later how seriously I had been injured. I heard about it. I heard, you know, the doctor said I wouldn't survive. But I didn't really know until I was doing a piece for a TV show, CBS Sunday Morning, which hasn't even aired yet. But they asked if there were any pictures of me taken right after the accident. I knew that there were, but I had never seen them. So we got those pictures, and when I saw me in those pictures, then I knew why they said I wouldn't survive. It was a very strange feeling looking at those pictures. Oh. There was, I wouldn't say a disconnect, but I looked at the pictures, and the first thing I did was look in the mirror.
And said, that's not me. That's not me.
Well,
you know?
Yeah, I mean, this is actually a technique that's used in the form of trauma therapy called somatic experiencing, where the therapist reminds you often that you are here now. You have survived. You've gone through this trauma. You're okay. You're going to be fine. And then they go back and they work a bit with the trauma. So it was like that. I saw what I looked like, and I couldn't believe it. I mean, then it was clear to me why they said that person could not survive. But before that, no, I had no idea.
And your wife had injuries.
Yeah.
How was she able to function and do all this for you?
Well, you want to speak about miracles. How does a mother lift a car to free her child?
Exactly.
I mean, we don't really know how these things work, but she was in severe pain. You know, another couple of centimeters, she would have been paralyzed. And yet, there just were miraculous moments. I've often told the story that when I was being helped away from the plane, that they wanted to do that quickly before the plane exploded, which it did. So a big crowd had gathered, and I was being helped up this slope out of the the rice field where we had landed. And every face that I looked at in that crowd just looked
Oh, my
horrified.
gosh. Stay with us, Alan. We're going to come back in a moment. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Alan, I'm glad this story had a happy ending to it, but along the way, it was probably bumpy, wasn't it?
Well, sure. It was more than bumpy. Certainly, oddly, what I thought was going to be the happiest time, specifically coming home from months of being in hospitals, turned out to be the worst because I thought I was coming back to my life, and that just wasn't the case. I was very weak. I had lost 25 pounds off of an essentially in-shape body. My hands had been badly burned, so they were ultra-sensitive. They were all regrafted, so, all new skin, tremulous, weak. I could do nothing for myself. I couldn't feed myself or wash myself or wipe myself. And it was just horrible for both of us, for my wife and myself. We had tremendous support, so much love and caring and people bringing meals. And it was incredible. And I think that's ultimately what got us through. But it was bleak and dark and depressing. All we talked about was, I want my life back. I want my life back. And I sometimes visually see it as standing at a door that's closed and locked, and my trying desperately to get that door open. And all that time, while I was trying to do that, I couldn't see all the doors that were open behind me. When somehow I finally turned around and saw what I could have as opposed to what I no longer would have, then things started to turn around. There were so many questions coming from strangers, from people in our meditation center, as to how did I survive. And then they saw that I was doing well. I hadn't just survived. I was really returning to the happy person I was. I was thriving. Within 5 months of the accident, I was back teaching a full schedule at the meditation center. I began, because of all the questions being asked, I began to write this book, Through the Flames, realizing that, well, I had gone through this, I didn't ask for it, but it happened. And I saw an opportunity to offer hope and to offer guidance, not for people who had been in a plane crash. Fortunately, there aren't many of us. But in a sense, we all go through crashes throughout our lives. Those crashes can be called divorce. They can be called the loss of a loved one or a serious illness or financial insecurity. We're going through things all the time. And quite frankly, if you survive the plane crash, you get a lot of attention.
Exactly.
And as I said, there was an opportunity to offer something to people. First of all, for people who deal with illnesses and accidents, the human body is miraculous. It's unbelievable what we can survive and what we can come through, even if there isn't a cure.
How much was faith involved in this with you?
Well, in my practice, faith is viewed differently in that it's not faith in something outside of ourselves, but rather a faith in one's own experience and what one has learned within one's own mind and body. You know, it's difficult to answer that because I don't know. There was so much struggle, but I don't think I ever considered anything other than being able to come back fully. You know, I never considered that I wasn't going to live through this. I never considered that in any way I was going to be stopped or handicapped, no matter what I could or couldn't do with my hands and my legs, which is where most of my injuries were. I never viewed it as something that was going to stop me. I think one of the reasons that I heal as well as I do, and I put that in the present tense, not in the past tense, because I am still healing, had to do with things that I've learned through meditative practice, such as just simply things happen. It's part of the nature of life. Wonderful things happen, beautiful things, joyful things, and also unpleasant things and difficult things. So sometimes people say to me, did you never ask why me? Why did this happen to me? And the truth is, I never did. Because it's a question that just wouldn't really make sense to me. The only answer to the question, why me, would be, why not me?
Bad luck, being in the wrong place at the wrong time?
Well, you know, if I wasn't in that place, I'd have to be someplace.
Someplace, that's
and
right.
And who knows what would have happened in
exactly.
that place.
Look at the poor story I had tonight, Alan, before you came in. They found an 18-month-old baby upside down in her car seat in a car that was in the water, in a river, but the mother had died. Now,
right.
You talk about being, sadly for the mother, in the wrong place at the wrong time. I can't think of anything sadder than that.
Yeah, and I think that as sad and as touching as these things are, they are part of the nature of this experience of human life. Life can be very difficult and present, you know, we can use the word crash. Life presents these crashes, these extremely challenging situations. There was one point when I realized that I was healing and I was doing well, and I was back at the hospital for a therapy appointment, and in the elevator I met this young, attractive woman who was in a wheelchair, and I thought to myself, what is her healing like? Has she been told you will never walk again?
Mm-hmm.
And then I thought, I need to start to meet and to interview people for this book who've not been as fortunate as I. And I met with four extraordinary people. One was a man who had built his own coffin. I read about him in the New York Times, and I found that he was a physician in Kansas, so we spent an afternoon on the phone together, and it was extraordinary that he had, over the course of 11 years, been able to come to grips with the fact that he had been diagnosed with fourth stage prostate cancer. He had lived a long time with it, but trying every kind of chemo and therapies. And now he was certainly near the end of his life. Actually, he passed away in November. But what he had come to was just one of the most beautiful stories that I've heard. A man who had a good life as a physician, helping people, had, as he said in his words, through the realization of his death, had come to begin to live life as the person he really wanted to be.
Could you have given up if you had wanted to, and do you think you would have died?
Well, I certainly think I would have died if I had given up, but it never came to me to give up. There was one point, it was probably the saddest moment that I can remember. My wife and I are very close, we have a very good relationship, and at one point she said it would have been better if we had died in that accident.
Oh.
And that was just devastating for me. Fortunately, we're well past that, but you know, we can sink pretty low when things are physically painful, emotionally chaotic, when you think you can't see a way out. And the whole motivation for me to work on this book is that there is a way out. There is a way that we can heal. And as I said, even if there isn't a cure, you know, it doesn't mean recovery and cure are not the same as healing. Healing is the mental and emotional part. And we can come back. We can develop the strength to come back. My experience now is I wouldn't wait for the next crash. I wouldn't wait for the next difficulty. I'd begin to look at my life, look at what's meaningful. There are some things that I wrote about that I think are are really essential, you know, as one, have an advocate. You never know when you're going to spend a day or a night in a hospital. And maybe you could be in a situation like mine where you're not all that cognizant or even conscious. You want to have someone who can speak for you. Mm. It might be a mate or a partner, or it might be a friend. And you make a deal with them. You say, look, I will be your advocate, you be mine. But I think we have to take those things seriously. Without my advocate, no way that I would still be alive. I couldn't have done it.
What would you say was the greatest lesson you learned because of this tragedy?
Well, the monumental points for me were the love and support of this huge community that we have here, community involving family, friends, strangers. I was told that on the other end of the world, Reverend Desmond Tutu was praying for us, and I've never met him.
Prayer works.
It must. Works, yeah. Something worked. What I've learned is that there are no strangers in the world. There was a woman, I wrote about this early in the book, as I was being helped up that slope away from the plane, and all those horrified faces were looking at me. There was one woman, just, you know, middle-aged, nondescript, but she leaned out from the crowd when I was right next to her, and she just said quietly to me, "You will be all right, sir."
Tell me about your reconstruction and the burns you sustained. What have they done since?
Well, there was a lot of grafting. The burns went very deep into my legs. I was very fortunate that I had shoes on. Well, I guess fortunate and unfortunate, because I think it was my shoe that actually caught on something. But at least my feet themselves were not burned. I was not able to walk afterwards, and it was very difficult relearning how to walk.
You could see with both eyes?
Yeah. The flame came very close to my left eye, and in the grafting, there's the socket of my left eye is now more red than the rest of the left side of my face, and I've shaved my head for years, so it's different. But it is fading. That red color is fading, probably in another 2 years or so. You don't really notice it. You know, if I didn't say something, you probably would notice it.
The picture of you in the book, in the back, is that a current picture? Or
pre-accident.
Is it... Pre-accident, okay.
Pre-accident, okay. Yeah. Although I've had, you know, we've done any number of photos for newspapers and other interviews, and it's fine. I have no problem with it. Little tiny piece of my ear missing, but originally, they thought I would lose the whole ear. So, you know, there's so much good that has come out of this. I have no complaints whatsoever. A couple of pains go through my hand. And, you know, I feel that pain and I say to myself, yes, but you still have these hands.
That's right.
And I came very close to not having them. So your perspective changes. That's one of the big things that you take away from something like this.
What do you say to people, Alan, and we'll take phone calls next hour from people who probably have gone through some similar things, maybe not as tragic as what you did, but, you know, car accidents and things like that. We'll just get them to share their stories with us. But what would you say to someone who, let's say, lost their legs and they truly were, you know, at this point they're giving up. They're giving up hope. What would you say to them today?
You know, the first thing that I would do would be to listen to them before I said anything. I think it's, you know, when I have taught, for instance, at Albert Einstein College of Medicine, I speak to the young doctors about learning listening skills. Listen to what is going on with that person. Hear their pain, hear their suffering. We know more than we realize that we know. And as they speak, they're really informing themselves. Because truthfully, what can I say to them?
I know. A little encouragement, but really not much.
Yeah, you know, I think it helps to know that somebody cares. I think that helps a lot, because often you think no one could possibly understand what you're going through. And in my case, no, I cannot understand what it's like to lose your legs, but I can understand what it's like to really go through something that's difficult. And what I would want people to know is you can do this. You can get through this. It's awful now. And don't be afraid to acknowledge that it's awful. This is terrible. It hurts. There's physical pain. You see no way out. But it's not the end. You can do this. The human body, as I said before, is miraculous. It's amazing what the human body can do. You know, you cut yourself in the kitchen, a little cut, immediately that cut is healing.
That's true. I'll tell you the cuts that hurt. Paper cuts. You ever get one of those? Ouch.
Yeah. Well, paper cuts and surface cuts actually hurt in a different way than what I went through, because my burns went very deep, in some cases all the way through to the bone and tendon.
Right.
And what's happening there is it's gone past the nerve endings. So, yes, it does hurt, but the real pain starts if you're fortunate enough to have those nerves regenerate.
Right, the growing back process.
Right, that's the painful part. But, you know, you can be so grateful that that's happening, and that doesn't mean it doesn't hurt.
Have you been on a plane since?
Yes. And I'm, you know, obviously planes getting me back home, but I wasn't conscious for those.
Right.
But I had agreed to, before the accident, I had some dates. One was in Seattle where I was going to teach, and I wanted to do it. I wanted to go. On the first anniversary of the accident, we actually flew. We didn't fly very far. We went to Cleveland, where my wife's family is. We have flown again, and we have coming up a major safari, because we love going to Africa, and that's a lot of flying and a lot of small planes internally in Africa. And I know people will think that we're crazy to do that, but, you know, I want to go on with my life. I've been so blessed and so fortunate to survive and to thrive. You know, truthfully, I'm having a really good time.
Good for you.
Because this moment right now, chatting with you, chatting with your listeners, is nothing better. This moment is incredible.
You're a walking miracle, Alan.
Maybe so. You know, I went to the dictionary. In fact, I keep three or four dictionaries at my desk because, you know, I am an author. And I looked up miracle. And essentially it says an event or condition or situation that is unexplainable, often then credited to a divine agency.
Yeah.
We don't know.
I was going to ask you if you felt that there was something angelic or divine involved in your miracle to come back.
That's very interesting that you asked that, because a friend just read that story that I told you about the woman on the hill who said, "You'll be all right,
yeah,
sir." Well, I never had seen that woman before. And never saw her again. And my friend said that was an angel.
She may have been. Stay with us, Alan. We're going to take this break. Then we're going to come back. We will open up the phone lines for people who, one, want to just ask you a question about what you've been through, what we've been talking about this hour. And also perhaps they'll share their stories on how they pulled and survived tragedies as well. If you need to email me, that's George@coasttocoastam.com.